Hi, I'm Sarah Kuhn. Welcome to the Juno Women Podcast, where I sit down for candid conversations with women who are experts in their field and share their specific knowledge so that we can become better equipped to handle all things motherhood. Juno Women is an extension of Juna, a fitness and nutrition app created to help guide you through your trying to conceive, pregnancy, and motherhood journey. Everything we do at Juna is designed to empower and support you through one of the most incredible and challenging times of your life. Today, I'm talking to Casey Seiden, a registered dietitian and certified diabetes care specialist. We talk about why you don't need to freak out if you get the gestational diabetes diagnosis and some of the best ways to manage gestational diabetes for both you and baby. I hope you enjoy. Casey, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I'm so excited to have you.
Likewise. Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Let's start by you introducing yourself and telling us just a little bit about you and your area of expertise.
Sure. Yeah. So again, I'm Casey Seiden. I am a registered dietitian and also a certified diabetes care and education specialist. I'm based out of New York City. I have been a dietitian for a little over 5 years now and have primarily always worked in the field of diabetes, but over the past 2 years have transitioned more into diabetes and pregnancy or gestational diabetes and a lot more prenatal and pregnancy and postpartum nutrition care. I currently work at a private high-risk OB clinic here in Manhattan, but I also have a private practice where I see women virtually for mostly pregnancy and diabetes related things, but lots of other women's health related issues as well.
So, curious, what other women's health related issues?
I've had quite a few clients for PCOS, endometriosis, people all, you know, preparing for maybe IVF, like embryo transfers and things like that.
I also didn't realize the like rigor in which it requires to be a certified diabetes counselor. That's like pretty intense, right?
Yes. There are a few requirements that you have to meet to get that extra certification. So you have to be a certain health profession. Nurses can do this, PAs, RDs. You have to be in your field for at least 2 years. You have to get so many practice hours. And luckily for me in my first job, that's all I did was diabetes. So I got those practice hours really quickly. It was just time ticking away, waiting for me to hit that 2 year anniversary of being an RD. And then I sat for the exam, which since I'd been doing it every single day, to me, honestly, that exam felt pretty easy, but I know it is challenging for a lot of people.
I think I had mentioned to you on our first call, but my husband's a type 1 diabetic. And so I just remember, I feel like I'm much closer to it than I want to be. But, and when I say want to be, it's just a terrible, it's for him, it's like a lot, just the management of it is so intense. And he onset much later, like I think of the 1% of diabetics that are type 1. Like 1% of them onset after the age of 10, and he onset at 23. So he had to learn how to manage that as an adult who had already like had very specific habits. And I think of gestational diabetes as very similar. It's this, you've been living a very specific way, and then all of a sudden you have to adjust, and it's a steep learning curve. So I'm excited to have you on the podcast to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, that is so true. I don't think I knew that about your husband, but that analogy is like perfect. It does both of those diagnoses at that point in your life. It flips you on your head.
So at a high level, can you just tell us what gestational diabetes is, who is at risk for it, and the risks it might pose for my baby?
Sure. Yeah. So gestational diabetes is a specific type of diabetes that we first discover in pregnancy. So we're not talking about someone who had pre-existing, whether they knew it or not, like pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes before they got pregnant. Gestational diabetes, or what we can call like GDM for short, is just discovered in pregnancy. And it really is a form of carbohydrate intolerance. So the placenta in your pregnancy is making certain hormones that is making mom intolerant of high amounts of carbohydrate. And she becomes what's called insulin resistant. So that insulin hormone that's supposed to lower blood sugars, mom becomes resistant to it and it's not working as well. And then that sugar from the food that we eat that's broken down in your blood stays high, and that then can get crossed over the placenta to baby. So that's where we talk about, yep, what are the big risks and outcomes of having this condition? In terms of baby, it means that they'll take mom's extra sugar, they'll start to produce their own insulin, which kind of acts like a fat storage hormone. So sugar is being turned into nice cushy body fat for baby. And the concern then is just that baby's growing too large too quickly, which could lead to all sorts of problems at delivery if they have those big broad shoulders, getting stuck coming down the birth canal, more bleeding, tearing for mom, or even just that risk of C-section is a big one too.
Is storing more fat when you're in utero, is that indicative of like your fat storage later on in life too? Are these kids more likely to be obese, or what does that look like?
So we do know there is a little bit of basically like fetal programming going on. So if in utero, the baby's pancreas is, you know, attuned to that high sugar environment, and then they're exposed to that again as a young child or as an adolescent, then their pancreas is going to remember that, and they might end up storing more fat, or their pancreas just starts to get tired. So we might see more childhood adolescent obesity or them developing type 2 diabetes earlier in their life.
I don't want to be a scary podcast episode where someone who hears this and they're like, oh my God, like the likelihood, if you manage gestational diabetes, then you can have a perfectly healthy baby, right?
Exactly. Yes, you definitely can. It's a very common pregnancy complication. We used to say that it was only like 5 to 10% of pregnancies, but we're really seeing it upwards in more like 18 to 20%. And a good percentage of those women can manage it and have very healthy babies, very healthy futures. Yeah, so absolutely. We don't mean to fearmonger or scare, because it can happen to any of us who become pregnant, really.
Yeah.
There are certain risk factors, but.
Okay, let's talk about those risk factors.
Yep. So risk factors, we look at a lot of things that aren't in our control. So age being one of them. Research says over the age of 25. I think I more commonly see it over the age of 30 and above. Things like race and ethnicity will be a big risk factor. Family history. So if you have a first degree like parent or grandparent that has type 2 diabetes, that could put you more at risk. Or if your mom had gestational diabetes with you. If you had a history of a larger baby in a prior pregnancy, or you yourself have a known history of PCOS, like polycystic ovarian syndrome, coming into your pregnancy, those can all make you more likely to possibly get this diagnosis.
I have a couple friends that have had gestational diabetes, and one of them was with Kaiser, and for some reason, Kaiser like tests for it super early, or like tests for indications of it super early. And for her, it was right on. I think at 8 weeks or 7 weeks, she was tested, and it was like indicative that she was going to end up with it. And then both times she did. And I always thought they tested at around 28 weeks, but we'll get into that. Does it really start showing up that early?
True gestational diabetes, no. Okay. We would really only start to see that around 26 to 28 weeks, because that's when the placenta starts to produce those higher levels of hormones. So if it's showing up earlier, what that's maybe telling us is that even prior to them becoming pregnant, they had some underlying insulin resistance, which could be related to some kind of endocrine condition like polycystic ovarian syndrome, could be that genetic factor. I don't like to talk about it so much, but it is listed as a risk factor and something to consider. But what's your body weight and physical activity and lifestyle going into pregnancy? Possibly not losing weight in between pregnancies can increase that insulin resistance. And yeah, you might have a little bit of that earlier on in a subsequent pregnancy.
Got it. Interesting
that it tests so early. Yeah.
And they test your blood sugar, but they don't do anything about it. But she was like, oh, yeah, they said that my blood sugar was a little bit high, and that I would definitely, when the time came at 28 weeks, they were looking much closer.
It's upsetting almost, because if we don't intervene then, are we letting this person go and it's running away from us, and that person's more likely to be on insulin or medication later on.
And I will say, like, it wasn't like a totally healthy baby, totally a healthy person too, like normal body weight, worked out all the time. And that's why it is such an interesting thing. And I want to say it, and I know that you do this with your patients, but like the it's not your fault. I think like a lot of people with the gestational diabetes diagnosis like immediately feel guilty.
Yes.
As if they've done something, right?
Yes, there is so much shame around this diagnosis. You ask people how they're feeling when they first get it, and they just feel so disappointed in themselves. Like they were the ones that they were super nauseous in their first trimester and eating carbs on carbs on carbs because that's all they could tolerate. And they're like, oh my gosh, I shouldn't have been doing that. I caused this. And that's just completely not true.
We're going to take a quick break so I can tell you about the Juna app, the app that makes this podcast possible. Juna is the premier app for every stage of motherhood, with a 12-week trying-to-conceive plan and workouts, key nutrition information for every week of pregnancy and postpartum, plus 6 full video courses on birth prep, breastfeeding, newborn care, infant sleep, sleep from 4 to 12 months, and starting solids. The app is designed to be your number one companion from trying to conceive through your baby's first year of life. It also includes daily diaphragmatic breathing exercises, pelvic floor prep, daily tips and notes from me that are relevant to the exact things you are experiencing. These are so helpful for easing any fears and preventing the dreaded gestational Google mania, that sickness where you can't stop Googling every little thing that happens during pregnancy. Juna is available for both iOS and Android. Just search Juna in the App Store or go to juna.co. Again, that's juna.co. The app is completely free to try for 7 days, and if you decide it's not right for you, you can cancel anytime within the first week, no questions asked. Download Juna today and get started. Now, back to the show. By the way, we all do that, even people without the gestational diabetes. Yes. All I ate was beige. Like, it is just So I'm glad that you said that. And like, it's just, it's what everyone does. And we all have to survive our first trimester. And some people end up with a diagnosis and some don't. And it's, so speaking of that, what are the things that I can be doing prior to pregnancy to help get myself healthy and to mitigate the risk of the diagnosis?
Yeah. So like we said, a lot of those risk factors are not in our control, but things that are potentially our weight, our diet, and physical activity. I'm not going to talk so much about the weight because that also is maybe not in our control, but our behaviors that might influence weight, such as diet and exercise, can. I think that conversation in preconception is really important to get people to look at their movement habits. Are you moving at all? None? Some? Can we build in some type of physical activity 5 days a week? 30 minutes, which like, I'll be perfectly honest, I don't even get that every single week. But if we can get close to that, building that muscle mass can be really helpful for blood sugar control when you are pregnant. And then from a diet and food perspective, not necessarily becoming obsessed with monitoring your added sugar intake and going like keto or anything like that. We still need carbohydrates. But if you're the type of person that was consuming multiple times in a week, let's say like pretty big bowls of white pasta or like fried Chinese food a few times a week, maybe looking at those habits and portioning down carbohydrates so they're a smaller portion of your meals, increasing your vegetable intake, and really starting to focus on proteins, because reconfiguring your plate and balancing it that way is going to help to set those blood sugars up for more success.
And it's probably just really good habits to get into for life in general, especially just for pregnancy as well, but like then for postpartum. And it's a lot of people have a hard time making small changes. And then all of a sudden when you're thinking about pregnancy and carrying a life, it's, oh, here's a great excuse to get healthy, right?
Right. Yeah. I always say like a quote unquote diet that I prescribe, if you want to call it prescribing, for GDM is the same diet that I would recommend to pretty much all of us.
So you answered it right. So you typically test for gestational diabetes between 26 and 28 weeks. What does that test look like? And walk me through that sequence.
Yeah, so there's two different methods for it. Other countries use what's called a one-step method, but here in the United States, we use this two-step method. So typically at that 26-week mark, you go in and you'll complete your first glucose test, which entails drinking a 50-gram solution of glucose, which is a very sugary beverage if you've drink that before.
Yep.
So you will drink that. You don't have to be fasted for it. And then you'll get your blood drawn an hour later. And so depending on that result, if it's elevated, then they'll have you go on to step number two, which is the 3-hour glucose test, where you would drink a 100 gram glucose solution. But this one you have to be fasting for. So they would draw your blood fasting, you drink the drink, and then they'll check your blood sugar at 1, 2, and 3 hours. And of those 4 blood draws, 2 of them have to be elevated to get that positive GDM diagnosis.
Now I'm curious, because I think we're seeing more of this in the last, I would say, 2 years. But a lot of people are like, I don't want to drink that drink. So what's your position on like other options?
Yeah, I wish we had other standardized things we could turn to. Unfortunately, the internet blogs that talk about eating dates or dried dried fruit or doing the jelly bean test, they're not standardized ways that you should assess your glucose control through. So the second best option is to really do some home blood sugar monitoring. So talk with your OB, see if they could help prescribe you a glucometer. And without going into it, like, I'm going to do perfect these 2 weeks and change up my diet so that I pass, just doing your normal diet, eating the way that you normally would, you would check your blood sugar 4 times a day for about 2 weeks. And then your team would use their clinical judgment if they can tell that you maybe would have tested positive for it through the Glucola or not.
I did that with my 3rd pregnancy. And I felt a little more comfortable doing that only because I had 2 pregnancies where I didn't have a gestational diabetes diagnosis. And, you know, it just wasn't even close. And I was with a midwife with my 3rd one. And I was just like, oh, I don't want to go and drink that again. And it's but I don't know if I would have felt as comfortable or as capable. And also, to be fair, I had lots of blood, we have 65 glucometers around our house, sure, just because my husband has all that stuff. But yeah, so it was much, much easier for me. Okay. And so after you get the gestational diabetes diagnosis, what are next steps for a patient?
So hopeful next steps are that within hopefully 24 to 48 hours, they're referred to and get to have their first visit with like a dietitian or a diabetes educator, or a combo of the two is the amazing perfect duo. So that's typically what happens where I work. So having that initial visit to set you up with the monitoring supplies, go through what that looks like, and provide you with some baseline nutrition education. I think every practice is different then on who's taking the reins. Some practices just give you that leaflet and say, okay, good luck. I'll see you at your next appointment in a month and we'll see how your blood sugars are doing. But I really think more of that constant support, like a weekly look at a person's blood sugar logs, them having the ability to ask their medical team, their dietitian or nurse or diabetes educator, like any questions, because it's really hard to get all that education in one session or just from a pamphlet, because it's a total trial and error process. And so I think having that more consistent support is really helpful for these mamas.
Now, you might not know this, so I'm just asking because I'm interested, but how typical is it for someone to have ongoing support after they get the diagnosis? Is it more typical for them to have one meeting with a diabetes educator and then they're left fend for themselves, or is more ongoing support more typical?
I think it's 50-50. I think some practices, and they do a really good job of getting you more hands in the pot, so to speak. So they'll refer you to a high-risk doctor, like a maternal fetal medicine specialist, and some of them are fantastic at being your point person every week or every other week to review things, especially if you end up needing to be on medication. Then I think that discussion and support is a lot more frequent. But I've definitely come across people who reached out to me privately through social media that they had one visit and that's it. And so then they turned to the internet. There are some great books out there. There are some other online programs and resources. I think we do need more dietitians and people providing that more long-term support if people need it for this condition.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think I cannot imagine having one appointment with someone and you're drinking from a fire hose. And then to your point, it's like, what may work for one person doesn't work for somebody else, and then what? And I think that's exactly. So with that, like, obviously I know that everybody is different, but do you have some go-to tips that you provide your patients, like in terms of like how to plate their meals? What are some go-to snacks and like how they should think about like setting up their meals?
Yeah, definitely. I think the two words that I repeat over and over again in my sessions with patients is consistency and balance. We're really looking for in a day to have your meals and snacks be consistent. They don't have to be the same schedule every single day, but blood sugars really do appreciate kind of a consistent intake of food and energy. So not going 5-6 hours without eating something. That just causes your blood sugars to be on this crazy roller coaster ride. So a loose structure of 3 meals with about 2 to 3 snacks, depending on your hunger, your fullness, your schedule. I find that is a pretty good structure for people to think about for their day. And then building their meals and snacks, we're taking a big zoomed out approach and thinking about how to balance it between the foods that are going to raise blood sugars and the foods that are going to help to blunt blood sugar spikes. So carbohydrates is that big group that will obviously break down into sugar and increase blood sugars. But things that are higher in fiber, protein, and fat, those are the blood sugar helpers to keep it nice and stable. Whether it's a meal or a snack, we want to try to think of having at least 2 of those food groups together. So carbs and protein or carbs and fat, those pairings and balance is really going to help with that glucose control.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like that's how I eat too. I'm always like, oh, if I'm going to have toast, I'm going to put avocado on it or an egg. And that's just always how I've been. And realizing now that that actually really helps with blood sugar control.
Yeah, and it's just so much more filling that way too.
Yeah.
And pregnancy appetite can just be ever-changing. And so no one wants to feel consistently hangry all the time. So it intuitively makes sense to eat that way from that perspective too.
Are you a breastfeeding mom needing to boost her milk supply or a nursing mom wanting to maintain good milk supply during your pregnancy? Well, we are excited to introduce you to GoLacta, an all-natural galactagogue and superfood. Many moms and health professionals around the world are calling the miracle supplement. 100% made from nature's own galactagogue, their pure moringa leaves are farmed by GoLacta out in the Philippines. Vitamin C, calcium, potassium, and protein. Moringa leaves pull double duty. They're both plant-based superfood and a galactagogue. So both moms and babies will reap the nutritional benefits of the moringa leaves. Added to being an amazing superfood, GoLacta is the ideal supplement for nursing moms and is not only clinically proven safe to use while pregnant, but because of its superfood qualities, it also provides moms and babies the key nutrients they need for healthy living and growth. I wish I knew about this during my breastfeeding journeys, but I'm just glad I get to share this with you today. You can buy yours today from the GoLacta website, www.golacta.com. Available in easy-to-use capsules or in a powder, so you can incorporate it into some of our amazing smoothie recipes in the app. Use code capital GL-JUNA21 for 15% off your first order. Once again, you can order today on their website and use the code GL-JUNA21 for 15% off your order. The other thing I wanted to ask too, because I think as soon as someone gets a gestational diabetes diagnosis, their initial thought is, oh my God, I can't eat carbs anymore or no sugar. And so is there, I know in my husband's sake, there's things that he just cannot control, like rice for one thing. He just cannot manage it. So that's one of the things. But sweet potatoes are totally like something that work for him. Quinoa is something that works for him. And so do you have some favorite carbs that you recommend people eat over others?
Yeah, I definitely do steer people more towards those complex, higher fiber types of carbs. So rice, for example, yes, white rice is probably going to be difficult to tolerate for most people. We can always tinker with the portion size, but let's say you just want a bigger portion of rice. I'd lean towards more of a wild rice or a brown rice even. Quinoa is another good one. Other ancient grains like farro or doing like some bulgur or barley. Like it's a fun trip. Yeah. I like to try to encourage people to think of it as a fun trip in the supermarket, experimenting with things that you might not have ever tried before. Because yeah, we can still have those carbs. We just have to find those higher fiber ones. And a lot of the times it comes down to the portion size of it and what you're having it with at the meal too, I think.
Yeah. And so let's talk a little bit about blood sugar control then, because I think like for anyone listening, they may be like, okay, so what are you actually looking at? What do I do? What is a high blood sugar? What is it? Like, what is that? So if you can break that down to simple terms, that would be great.
Sure. Yeah. And I think these goals that I'm going to talk about are pretty standard across the board. Some OB practices might have different goals. And that can also be very individualized depending on how the baby's looking, what other risk factors they have. But generally speaking, we're looking for the fasting blood sugar, which is the one that you would take first thing in the morning, to be below 95. And then we usually have you check after breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And you can check either 1 hour or 2 hours after the meal. If you're checking 1 hour, then we have the goal of 140. And if it's 2 hours after, less than 120. And we're usually counting that hour or 2 hours from when you take the first bite of food. So that's something that really like catches people by surprise. Oh, shoot, I've been doing it wrong. It's not that it's wrong, but by starting it from the first bite of food and timing it from there, we're really going to catch that peak glucose rise a little bit better than if it was at the end of the meal.
Can you manage your GDM purely through diet, or are most people on insulin?
Yeah. So I would say like for my patients, probably 80 to 85% of them are able to control it just through diet and lifestyle. The one that becomes really tricky for a lot of people, if they had no pre-existing diabetes, pre-diabetes, none of that, when they're diagnosed with GDM, the tough one that might necessitate starting medication is that for that fasting blood sugar. And that has a lot more to do with the hormones, and it's something we can't really control. So if you notice, our cutoff is like when we're seeing more than 50% of a person's fasting blood sugars over 95, let's say for a period of a week to 2 weeks, they've tried everything and it's still not coming down, then we'd say, okay, that fasting blood sugar needs some help. Let's talk about medication. The medication options that we would discuss then would be insulin. That's usually the first one that we go to, just because it's really effective. It can be dosed individually and adjusted very precisely over some of the oral medications. It doesn't cross the placenta, and it's, like I said, it's really effective. So taking an injection of insulin at night to help lower that fasting. I know it's an injection, and that scares a lot of people, and they've known people on insulin. They're scared that they'll never get off of it. Like after their pregnancy, they think they'll have to be on it forever. But that's not true. It comes in a really handy, easy to use. I try to get people a teeny tiny needle, this little pen device. So it's really not as bad as a lot of people envision it. And you would want to make sure what the signs and symptoms are of hypoglycemia, like having too low blood sugar, because there's a risk there. But otherwise, insulin is very effective and very safe. If someone doesn't want to do insulin, one of the oral medications is a medication called metformin. So metformin could be taken to help with the fasting value. It can also help daytime blood sugars too. And that's really working to help with that insulin resistance piece and also telling your liver to not put out so much glucose, which is a lot of what's happening overnight and in those early morning hours. So those would be the two most common, I would say.
Okay. And then I've managed my gestational diabetes, I've had my baby. What does postpartum look like now?
Yep. So once you deliver the placenta, which is what was causing all those hormonal changes and blood sugar issues, your blood sugars will pretty rapidly return to normal for the most part. So no more finger sticks, no more medication or insulin if you were on it. What's recommended and strongly encourage is to follow up with your OB around your 6 to 8 week postpartum visit to complete another glucose test. So this one is actually just a 75 gram test where they'll check your blood sugar at 1 and 2 hours. And that's really going to help us to see, are your blood sugars totally back down to normal, or is one elevated and maybe we should do some closer follow-up with your PCP, or do you already have, after your pregnancy, signs of prediabetes and you'd want to get referred to an endocrinologist. If everything looks fine, then we just recommend getting a yearly or every other year a hemoglobin A1C test, which is another blood sugar test. No drinking the drink. It's just a blood sample through like your primary care doctor. And diet-wise, it's, again, I'll try to talk about a GDM diet in pregnancy as the same type of balanced diet that I would encourage all of us to try to adapt. You don't have to be counting your carbs and maybe so careful about where sugar's coming in, et cetera, but being mindful, still creating that balance on your plate and moving your body.
This has been super helpful. Any last tips that we haven't covered or that you think is worth noting here for anyone who's super interested in because they have gestational diabetes?
I would just say reach out for help. This is not a condition that you need to feel like you have to do alone. There are a lot of resources, professionals that want to help you. So if you're feeling really stuck with this diet, if you're completely miserable, feeling like deprived and restricted of everything, know that it probably doesn't have to be that way. So there are great communities out there. I would reach out for some support.
Okay. With that, why don't you tell people where they can find you?
Yes. Great segue. Yeah. I'm mostly on Instagram. So my handle there is eat.together. So at eatwelltogether. My website, which I'm sure you can put in the show notes, is caseysidennutrition.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Casey. This has been so helpful and I really appreciate your time today.
Same. Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Okay. That's all for today. If you liked today's episode, please share it with a mama friend and leave us a review. If you're pregnant, postpartum, or trying to conceive, you can download the Juna app completely free for 7 days. The app is available for iOS and Android and is designed to be your guide for all things health and fitness for this very special time of your life. If you have any suggestions for episodes you would like to hear or anyone you think would be a great guest on the show, please email me directly at sarah@juna.co. Thank you so much for listening and I'll see you next week.